Welcome to the Conan Doyle Casebook, where there's always a story to tell.
Well, hello once again, and welcome to our series of the Conan Doyle Casebook. And today, I'm speaking to Peter Braun, film producer, such things as Rob Roy, The Flying Scotsman, and a very keen interest in the paranormal and UFOs. So welcome, Peter. Hello.
Hello, Ewan.
Now, I have to ask, where did your interest in, I suppose, the paranormal, but particularly UFOs, where did that kind of come from?
It's hard to be specific about that, but when I was a kid, I was really interested in comics that had kind of the weird stuff. There was one particular comic, I think it was Film Fun, but I can't remember, but it had a weekly feature or story called The Phantom of Blackfriars. And it was a kind of story, you know, but it was illustrated by one image at the beginning of the story. And the Phantom, I realised looking back, looked very much like Bela Lugosi in Nosferatu. The Phantom was very sort of difficult to pin down and always got away and so on. But, you know, that's a strong memory from childhood. And we had very few books in our house, unfortunately. But the ones that we did have, the ones that I sort of found myself bringing in early, were the Pan Book of Horror Stories and similar. And there was always that thing in the background of, you know, being interested in the strange, the ghostly, the weird, and the unusual. I think during my professional life, I was more focused on other more material stuff, if you like. But as I got older, that interest began to grow again, culminating, I suppose, in 2014 when I set up and ran the Scottish Paranormal Festival in Stirling, which was a major festival. It wasn't just talks and lectures. It had ghost stories for children. It had theatre. It had film. It had ghost hunts. It had Vampire Kaylee, and so on. It was at Halloween, and it was a tremendous festival. Various people helped, particularly Nick Kyle, who was then the president of the SSPR. So it took a lot of preparing. It was a good year's work, but I managed to lose money that I didn't have to lose at the end of it. Quite a lot of money still paying off. It's a good model, I think, for a festival again, but I wouldn't do it unless I was sure of not losing as much money as I did. It was perhaps a bit overambitious, but always better to be overambitious than underambitious, I think. So that's what it took me to. And that interest has got stronger in the past few years, because I've been working on a movie, a feature film, based on the true events of the Rendlesham Forest incident in Suffolk in 1980. And we can maybe talk about that separately, but that's a feature film project, a feature movie based on fact, if you like, about the two local women in Suffolk who heard about these extraordinary UFO incidents adjacent to the massive American nuclear base that was there at the time, and how they brought it to the attention of the world. So, and very recently, I've been particularly taken with the series of Tuesday talks at the Arthur Conan Doyle Centre, which have been absolutely superb. And we've been lucky to be presented with some very big thinkers, you know, who are really advanced in their various fields, not just woo-woo merchants, because although I'm interested in the paranormal and so on, I'm also suspicious of people who make unsubstantiated extreme claims for things. Very much want to see evidence of stuff before I begin to believe it. And the theme that has run through all of those talks really has been the fundamental question of the primacy of consciousness. And that's, I think, what I'd probably say was my main interest at the moment. But that relates to ufology, but we can maybe get to that later.
I was going to ask you about the incident at Suffolk. What happened there with the two women?
They were investigators rather than experiencers. Over 3 days at Christmas 1980, it was an extraordinary series of sightings and landings, and perhaps one or two actual alien sightings on night three. Alien craft coming down in Rendlesham Forest. The base there, the twin base of Bentwaters Woodbridge, was an RAF base that was on lease to the Americans. It was a massive piece of Americana dropped into rural Suffolk. It had 500 nuclear weapons on site, with the planes not far away that could deliver them at the height of the Cold War. And that in itself sort of points to a strong thread of factuality about ufology, because UFOs, or UAPs as they're sometimes now called, have a very strong interest to sites of nuclear production, plutonium production, nuclear power stations, but particularly nuclear warfare-related nuclear activity, such as missile launch sites and the like. And there's a remarkable book by Robert Hastings called UFOs and Nukes, which has hundreds of interviews with mostly military personnel who have experienced UFO appearances at UFO sites. Some of the most alarming involved UFO appearing over the Malmstrom missile base in 1967 and turning off the ten silos, so that they basically took over control of the operation, and meant that part of the American nuclear defense system, which I hate anyway, I'm sure many people watching these, listening to these podcasts, will share my horror of nuclear warfare and all that goes along with it. But that's what UFOs seem to be interested in as well. There's a strong case to be made on the evidence available that there's advanced civilizations are a bit concerned about what we're doing to ourselves, and as we push ourselves perhaps towards the edge of Armageddon. But that interest in nuclear sites was similar at Rendlesham, and that's the smart money's on that being the reason why the UFOs were appearing there. Yeah. The two women that you asked about were the ones who heard about the case a few days later at a New Year party. And Brenda Butler and Dot Street, and who had it. They also were interested in the weird stuff, but they were told by an American airman who attended the party about the stuff that had gone on, and they were a bit sceptical at first, and they went out and started to interview people locally, and then built up a massive evidence that that what had happened really did happen, and it culminated in 3 years later through American Freedom of Information, the memo that was written by the deputy base commander, Colonel Charles Holt, was got out and made public, revealing that the activity on and around the base had been very real and had actually happened.
One of the things I did find really interesting is, of course, growing up and even up to a couple of weeks ago, I always considered UFOs as unidentified flying objects, and that was always the term that was used. But then you mentioned unidentified aerial phenomena, which seems to be the new phrase for that, and I think kind of the government phrase for it.
Yeah, I think that the phrase UFO had acquired too much cultural baggage. When the new UFO age began in 1947 with the Kenneth Arnold sightings in Washington State, and a couple of days later at the famous events at Roswell in New Mexico, popular culture latched onto the mass of sightings, the rash of sightings that happened, especially in America in the intervening years, the years following. So there was a genuine campaign of disinformation, part of which was to ridicule the phenomenon and to ridicule people who were seriously looking at it, taking it seriously and presenting it to the world. So I think that the switch of terminology happened because they wanted to get rid of that sort of that that sort of curse of ridiculousness that UFOs had sadly come to represent. And it crept into even Hillary Clinton's campaign a couple of years ago, when the Clintons were actually very interested in the phenomenon, although they tried to keep it quiet because it wasn't a vote winner, but they had a relationship with Lawrence Rockefeller, one of the famous rich Rockefeller family, who was also particularly interested. And Hillary had been asked in her campaign about it, and she started to use the phrase unidentified aerial phenomena. And that's the phrase that the military and the government have picked up and run with since, to keep it sounding more scientific, I suppose.
And it appears as well that over the years there's more and more officials willing to speak about UFOs. And one, the New York Times, for instance, which you mentioned to me a week or so ago, that looks at John Ratcliffe, the former director of National Intelligence, who told Fox News that quite a few of these phenomena, these UFOs, are quite difficult to explain. And then we have a John Brennan, the former director of the CIA, that says the phenomena is a result of something that we don't understand, and it could involve some type of activity that some might say constitutes a different form of life.
Absolutely. I mean, since 1947, to try and sort of like present the history of ufology in a very potted way, there's been Himalayas of evidence of activity in the skies and landed craft and all the rest of it. There has been massive data points, as they're now called, about it. And some rather, how can I put this? There have been American government inquiries, but famously Project Blue Book is the best known of them into the phenomenon. But they have tended to exist to dismiss the phenomena before they actually even started. You know, they don't really want to admit to the reality of it. So you have all of this going on, and then from 1969, a denial on the part of the American government that they were at all interested in UFOs, because whatever was going on, it wasn't a threat to national security. In reality, they were still looking at it. And what became apparent with the famous, now famous, New York Times article on December the 17th, 2017, was that the stuff was going on, and there were programs that were government funded that had continued for a long time. These programs had been started. A guy called Senator Harry Reid, who was no less than the leader of the Senate in the American government, he came from Roswell, New Mexico, and that might explain why he had an interest in this. He's still alive. I'm not referring to him in the past tense, but Harry got together a couple of other senators, three of them, you know, had an interest and were concerned that what was happening in the skies was potentially a real and genuine threat to national security. So they managed to secretly or discreetly, shall we say, get $22 million of government funding into a program that was looking at, it wasn't just looking at UFOs, it was looking at all sorts of weird stuff. And they even, Skinwalker Ranch had a research program based there, the famous Skinwalker, notorious Skinwalker Ranch, which was partly funded by that. And that process formulated eventually into the Advanced Aerospace Threat Identification Program, ATIP, which was looking very specifically at UAPs. When people opened their Times on that day in December, it was a real sort of like sea change moment. It was a paradigm shift, because you had the most respected newspaper in the United States saying, well, pointing to stuff and linking to three videos that seemed to point very directly towards the reality of this stuff, and revealing that the program had been going on, and revealing that Lou Elizondo, who had been in charge of the program, had left just before the article appeared. He'd resigned his post because he felt that it wasn't being funded properly, and indeed there was an opposition in government and in the Pentagon to the program among some quarters, because they genuinely thought it was demonic in nature, the phenomenon that was being dealt with. That says quite a lot about, you know, the current state of the United States of America and the sort of fundamental Christian nonsense that informs much of their way of seeing the world, many of the population and the representatives. So, you know, Elizondo was out there. He was related to an organization which was formed by a pop singer, a rock singer from Blink-192, Tom DeLonge. And a number of individuals, Chris Mellon, DeLonge, Hal Puthoff, very high-powered people in their own fields were, you know, pushing for what's called disclosure. And they've got a lot to be congratulated for in bringing forward what eventually became the report that was partly published last Friday, into the phenomenon. What was revealed in 2017 meant that Pandora's box was now open. The genie was out of the bottle and it couldn't be easily put back in again. It had to be taken seriously. There was too much evidential stuff on the table. And indeed, pilots were coming forward and saying, you know, to the nation on news programs and documentaries, this is what I saw. And what they had seen, what they were reporting, and this relates to the videos from the Nimitz aircraft carrier deployment in 2004 off San Diego, when for weeks they were being followed by at least 100 craft very high up in the sky being detected on radar. And then eventually Commander Fravor and his wingman, who was a wonderful female pilot, going up to investigate. And what they saw was they saw a foaming in the water below them, and then a craft emerging and shooting up into the sky and then playing tag with them, you would say, to summarize it. But the same craft was also observed to descend from 28,000 feet to sea level in 0.78 of a second, which is actually quite impossible in physical terms. It that defies all the laws of physics. In fact, there was a really excellent piece by a guy called Kevin Knuth who looked at the physics behind that, and he said, since we want a minimal power estimate, we took the acceleration as 5,370 G, and assumed that the UAV had a mass of 1,000 kilograms. The UAV would then have reached a maximum speed of about 46,000 miles an hour during the descent, or 60 times the speed of sound, without a sonic boom, I have to say, at which point the required power peaked at a shocking 1,100 gigawatts, which exceeds the total nuclear power production of the US by more than a factor of 10. So that in itself, you know, is for me, was just like, that's manna. That's just, you know, here's evidential proof stuff that makes all the sort of mockery that you get every time you reveal to people in a conversation that you're interested in is, that's a lot of nonsense. Well, you know, here's some factuality, and then, you know, you come back with what you got. So that's why it was such an important day last Friday when the report was kind of revealed, except it wasn't, because it was only what you would call an executive summary. It was a nine pager which summarized what it was about and what, you know, their preliminary and conclusions were. But there's also an 80-page, it's reported, an 80-page confidential part of the report that we're not allowed to see.
And I think you kind of answered the question I was going to ask there, actually, in the whole law of physics and everything, because there are many that will say, well, how do we know they're of an alien being, or could there be some sort of advanced weapons system or technology that we're managing to find? And it could be that.
Well, if it's advanced, it's advanced in a quantum leap by a factor that is just beyond imagination. You know, we can't be... The report, one of its conclusions was that... you know, what was being studied wasn't of either US government technology or of foreign potential adversarial discovery. It was, if it's not that, then what is it? It's not something that the performance of the craft that I've just mentioned, you know, exceeds physics, the laws of physics as we know them, you know? And that's pointing in a direction which, you know, they all stop short of saying it's actually alien, but it's certainly not something that our civilization is currently capable of. So who knows what it is?
And the sightings of the crafts themselves, because, again, I remember growing up and a UFO was always a saucer shape object, as it was featured in Close Encounters of the Third. That was always a saucer, and everyone. But as time goes on, the images of the crafts have kind of changed. The sightings of the crafts has changed. So, are they advancing their technology, or I kind of wonder why they changed from what the sightings were originally.
Well, if you look out the window, you'll see cars going by, and you'll see other traffic, and they're not all the same shape. You know, it doesn't necessarily mean that. In fact, the phrase "flying saucer" came from the Kenneth Arnold sightings of 1947, when he reported it as being like saucers skipping across water. But what he'd seen were actually objects that were more like scimitar shaped. Yes, you get saucers. You get sightings which are saucer shaped. You get cigar shapes. Recently, there's been a lot of triangular UFOs. And we're also coming into a strange area of pyramid-shaped UFOs, very large. The Penn Turk incident that I'm currently investigating with the main witness happened in South Wales 5 years ago. And at 2 o'clock in the morning, she and her neighbour were going out for a short walk in the South Wales hills, just right outside her house. She saw a massive amount of military activity, and then the appearance of a 600-foot pyramid-shaped UFO right in front of them, only a matter of yards away. One of the aspects of that, that I should say in passing is important, is that it's better if there are multi-witnesses to any events for obvious reasons, and the Penn Turk incident has many, many witnesses. As to the shapes of UFOs, if it is alien civilizations that are visiting us, then possibly it is the plural, it's civilizations. Or maybe that's it, that one very advanced civilization is using different craft for different reasons. The stuff that happened around the Nimitz and the Eisenhower deployments in 2004 and 2017 looked to me very much like probably unmanned or unpersoned unoccupied craft, scout craft, if you like, drones, if you like, but possibly connected to a bigger entity higher up in the sky. Because some of the craft that have been seen and multi-witnessed are very, very large indeed. If you go back to the Phoenix incident, one of my favorite ones, Phoenix Lights incidents of 1997, when tens of thousands of inhabitants of Phoenix, Arizona, and surrounding towns and cities. So I see a fleet of craft flying over three states. Some of the closer witnesses, and I've spoken to one of them in particular, who was, and her mother, who were driving home from a swim meeting, and saw and had the whole of the Phoenix Valley in front of them. And they saw that the craft passed over them. They reckoned it was 7 miles wide. 7 miles wide. Where do you park such a thing? You know, if that's part of our advanced technological progress on this earth, I don't think so. It's stuff like that you know, it's exciting because it's real and it's true and it's beyond our current imaginings about what we ourselves can do. Consider, and it's, as I say, it was a multi-witnessed event. They weren't the only people who saw such a monstrously large craft.
Do you think, you know, the governments, the different governments seem to have their own case files or investigative studies into UFOs? Do you think there's any collusion between governments or There's perhaps, I don't know, just kind of some sort of global cover-up, global silence on them.
Different countries actually have this. I've talked a lot about the US because most of the stuff comes out of the US. The most reported stuff comes from the US. And indeed, the figures would say that there's more sightings there than anywhere else. But different countries have different protocols. Some of the South American countries are very open about it, like Chile, and to a degree Brazil. The French are very open about it as well. They admit to, you know, studying the phenomena and taking it seriously. So there's also, I think, there's distrust and collusion probably going on between governments because governments don't want to give too much away. They don't even want to give too much away about what they don't know and what they don't have, if you know what I mean, as well as what they do know and what they do have. But I think you only have to look at the way that some witnesses have been, if this is the right answer to your question, you governments have interfered in this from the beginning. In 1947, the famous Roswell incident crash in the New Mexico desert, more closer to the town of Corona than Roswell, actually. But it's become very famous. But what's less well known is how threatened, to what degree hundreds of people who were witnesses or who were the family of witnesses even were threatened with death by the American military. There was a very deliberate military action in the wake of the sightings, sorry, the landings, the crash. it's pouring with rain outside. I got distracted. It's quite alarming at what governments, the lengths to which governments have gone to keep this as tight as they would like to keep it. And indeed, the Penturk incident, which we're looking at the moment, is actually potentially the most frightening of all because it might involve the shooting down of a UFO deliberately by the UK military. One of the very interesting things about the Nimitz and Eisenhower incidents is that the pilots and other Navy personnel were testifying to the existence of craft above them, as I said earlier, that had been going on for a week in both cases, hundreds of craft way above them. Sorry, I've lost my thread of thought. I might have to cut this bit out, but I'm going to get it back again. It was interesting that that both of the battle cruiser deployments that were referenced by the naval personnel involved, you know, with hundreds of craft following above them. It seemed to me and others that there must be a protocol within the military not to attack those kind of appearances, those kinds of sightings. They don't immediately shoot on sight, even if they don't know what it is. And you kind of wonder what's behind that. You kind of wonder, well, have there been instances in the past? And you go back to the strong rumors, never authenticated, about Eisenhower meeting alien civilizations in the desert to come to an agreement about this. Now, I certainly can't verify that, but it's a very strong rumor within the ufological community. When you look at the Penturk incident, you see something much more sinister. You see very, very strong evidence of a craft being deliberately shot down by the UK military, a craft which was not threatening and not posing any kind of danger to anyone. In fact, the opposite, which, according to witnesses, was sending out mental messages of peace and friendship. And that takes me to another lovely case in Ariel's school in Zimbabwe, but we'll come back to that maybe later.
So one final question. Do you think we might get a definitive answer in our lifetimes that there is, I guess, there is alien civilizations out there? And a definitive answer?
That depends. It depends how long our lifetimes are. I mean, I'm entering the winter of mine. I would love to think that we would have that evidence. There's a great phrase that's used all the time about, you know, people will only believe it when UFOs land on the lawn of the White House. And even then, you know, certainly the report of last week is bending over backwards, not to say nothing and not to say too much. I don't think any government, any of the major powers want to admit that they are dealing probably, possibly with civilizations that are way beyond us technologically. So we are defenseless in the face of such, you know, advanced technological and perhaps military power. So that admission will be dragged out of people, perhaps by that famous landing on the lawn when it can't be denied anymore. But until then, I think that, as happens now, governments and military will do everything they can to deny the very obvious that is happening right in front of their noses.
Well, it's a fascinating subject. It's been fascinating speaking to you. And if anybody wants to find out more information about you, or perhaps get in touch, where do they go to?
Well, they can go to my website, which is my Rob Roy Films website, and take it from there. There are contact details there. But they have to remember that I've also got a job, so I don't have limitless amounts of time to do. I'll be as helpful as I can.
Well, thank you very much for speaking to us, and hope that you'll come back at some point as well.
I'd love to. It's been great. It's always terrifying to, you know, put yourself in this position, because what I know is that size, and what I don't know is absolutely, you know, it's cosmic in size. So I hope we've managed to touch on some of the main points today.
Excellent, and thank you very much for speaking to us.
Thank you, Ewan. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.